Keeping all this a secret is going to be harder than I thought. It's for camp this summer. Avoiding the question feels better than not being honest. Mama just shrugs and focuses on changing lanes. I open the book again and flip through until I reach a page that catches my eye. It's a full-page photo of a bulky, bearded guy in a cowboy hat, decked out in a dark gray suit. He's aiming a flaming axe toward the camera, and his gray eyes are so intense, it's like he's daring me to turn the page without reading first. So I read. The caption says, "The closest thing to a superhero in the supernatural world. Join Agent Beauregard Magnus at the Department of Supernatural Investigations and start your journey toward becoming a special agent today." On the opposite page is a job listing. Department of Supernatural Investigations, Junior Agent. Minimum badge allowed to perform this job, bronze. Chief responsibilities, to serve and protect both humans and non-humans alike against supernatural threats, foreign and domestic. Enforcement of the laws that govern supernatural entities living in the known world. Those who excel in this position may be promoted to senior agents, surveillance agents, special agents, and more. Noteworthy agents, Beowulf, Captain Ahab, Abraham Van Helsing, Captain Nemo, Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, part-time researcher, part-time agent, Sherlock Holmes, Maria Van Helsing, and Quentin Peters. I can't believe it. Quentin's an agent, just like this guy in the picture. Of all the crazy things I've learned, this might be the craziest. Agent Magnus looks like the person you'd call if a bear got loose at the zoo. Quentin is afraid of spiders, even the tiny ones. As the clock on the dashboard blinks to 5:26, a question pops into my head. Mama, how much do you know about this summer camp? It's a really fancy leadership camp, says Mama. You guys take classes and go on trips to meet with CEOs and government leaders. Plus, you'll get to mingle and make friends with other high achievers. These kinds of programs will really pay off later as an adult. When it comes down to getting those cushy jobs, it's not what you know, but who you know. So Mama thinks this is just a leadership camp. That must be what they told her when she called, and what Quentin used to tell her too. Just make me a promise, okay? Mama continues. Promise me you'll go to college. You won't follow Quentin into whatever he was doing. So you think this, program had something to do with Quentin going missing? Of course not, says Mama, or I wouldn't let you near it. I don't know what could have happened to your brother. I just want you to use this program to get into a good university somewhere and live a safe and happy life. Safe and happy life. I can't help wondering if maybe deep down, Mama does know that his job is the reason he's gone. I promise, I say. I'm only entering this program to find out what happened to my brother. Once I do, I don't care if I ever see the supernatural world again. Even with all Mama's shortcuts, we don't turn onto the tree-lined entrance to the Vanderbilt Hotel until 6:02. I can't believe we're late. The building looks so cool, like one of those famous cathedrals, topped with a beautiful golden dome. A large white guy in a gray suit is headed up the wide stairs at the front of the building. I recognize his cowboy hat. That's your escort, says Mama. Catch him before it's too late. I push open the door and step outside. Agent Magnus, I'm here. If Agent Magnus hears me, he doesn't stop or even turn around. I can't believe we've come all this way only to be too late. Hey, it's me, Quentin's little sister. I bounce back and forth, waving my hands over my head. praying that Agent Magnus will turn around. At Quentin's name, Agent Magnus pauses and turns to face me. He's twice as intimidating in real life. Those intense gray eyes size me up as he comes down to meet us. Mama gets out of the car and thanks him. He says something that makes her laugh and then gives her hand a kiss. Mama blushes and giggles. Of course they know each other. Mama used to drop Quentin off here every summer.
"Baby girl," says Mama, "introduce yourself."
Now that he's right here in front of me, I can't find any of the confidence I had a minute ago.
"Hello,"
I say, not able to meet Agent Magnus's eyes.
"You're late."
His voice is deep, with a raspy southern twang.
"Believe Mr. Ware said to be here at 6?
"I know," I say. "There was traffic and..." He puts up a hand to cut me off.
"One thing you're gonna learn is we don't make excuses. If you were anybody else, you'd be headed back home. But you had one favor owed to you on account of being Quentin's little sister. That favor's used up now. Understand?"
I nod.
"Yes, sir."
Agent Magnus turns his attention to Mama.
"Always a pleasure, Renee. I'll make sure Amari is well looked after."
Mama smiles.
"I know you will. You and Quentin were so close. I'm thankful you're taking the time to escort Amari on her first day."
"Great kid, Quentin."
A flicker of emotion passes across Agent Magnus's face.
"I'll send somebody down to collect Amari's things."
His eyes find me again.
"You ready?"
"I think so," I say. Agent Magnus grins.
"Oh, I doubt that very much."
8. The inside of the Vanderbilt Hotel is easily the fanciest place I've ever been. The lobby is huge, probably bigger than most people's houses. The floor glistens like it's permanently wet, and tall paintings hang on the walls. The hotel guests all look like really important people. Men and women lounge on plush chairs, sipping drinks brought to them by waiters in clean white uniforms, as music from the string quartet set up in front of the large fountain fills the lobby. My stomach knots, and here I thought I didn't fit in at Jefferson Academy. This looks like the kind of place the royal family of another country might stay if they were visiting America. I feel like a speck of dust on a beautiful painting.
"The Vanderbilt Hotel is one of many cover businesses the Bureau uses both to fund and conceal our organization. The building rests on a natural magic wellspring, which allows us an everlasting power source for much of what we do here. The hotel's a bit frou-frou for my taste, but they have a killer cigar selection."
I keep my head down as Agent Magnus leads me through the bright lobby to a small hallway marked "Authorized Personnel Only." At the end of the hall is a big metal door with a keypad in the center. I try to see what code Agent Magnus types in, but his fingers move too fast. After a series of clicks, Agent Magnus twists the handle and pushes open the door to another door. This one is even bigger, with a combination dial. Magnus turns it back and forth, like 10 times before the thing finally clicks and the door slides out of view.
"Welcome to the Bureau of Supernatural Affairs."
An enormous hall greets us, and I gasp. It's filled with all kinds of strange sights. A flock of fairies twinkles past like floating Christmas lights, their laughter like tinkling bells. They all wave to me in unison. A bit dazed, I'm about to lift my hand to wave back, when a loud shriek rings out. Witches zip by overhead on brooms, cackling madly and firing plumes of black smoke at one another. I looked to Agent Magnus, wondering if maybe somebody should do something about the witch battle going on above. But he doesn't seem the least bit interested. What in the world have I gotten myself into?
Follow me,
says Agent Magnus, moving into the crowd. I do, my head twisting in every direction, trying to see everything at once. On my left, two hulking giants have a very polite discussion about the literary merits of Hemingway. It starts out polite anyway. Soon, they're growling and stomping, and we make sure to give them plenty of space to avoid getting stepped on. Just when I think this day can't get any weirder, I nearly bump into three dripping wet green somethings with a whole lot of eyes. They're flipping through Places to See Away from the Sea brochures. It's not until we reach the clear elevators at the back that I realize I've been holding my breath this whole time. I wrap my arms around myself tight, my emotions all over the place. Is this real life?
You all right, kid?
Magnus asks with a grin. I nod stiffly, and he laughs.
We're all a bit shell-shocked in the beginning. Not to worry, you'll get used to it.
Agent Magnus takes hold of my shoulder and gently turns me back around to face the lobby of Supernaturals.
Now, one of the most important purposes of this here bureau is to ensure that scenes like this one continue to exist. A safe place within human cities and towns for supernaturals to meet and gather and conduct business. No glamours or disguises necessary. Heck, they barely even have to behave within these walls.
I think about the supernaturals I saw on the ride here and how Mama couldn't see any of them. They all must have been wearing glamours and disguises. He continues.
Supernaturals decided a long time ago that they'd be much safer hidden away from humans. And yet, outside of this place, the known world and the supernatural world are constantly slamming into contact in a thousand different ways every single day. So, for the privilege of remaining a part of their world, we here at the Bureau ensure these interactions occur in a way that keeps the supernatural world secret. Heck, we've got a whole department that does nothing but make up convincing stories to cover up some of the wacky things that happen.
Agent Magnus leads me to an open elevator, and we step inside. Once the door closes, a warm female voice says, "Welcome to the Bureau, Special Agent Beauregard Magnus, and trainee Amari Peters. It's so good to see that you've trimmed that hideous beard, Agent Magnus. It was truly becoming an eyesore." What the? I glance around for the source of the voice. It seems like it's coming from all directions. Magnus frowns.
Weren't you telling me how great it looked just the other day?
No, the voice answers. If I remember correctly, my exact words were, "You've certainly looked worse." That hardly constitutes a compliment. As Magnus chuckles, I have to ask,
"Just to be clear, you're having a conversation with the elevator?"
I mean, sure, I talk to my laptop sometimes when it's not working, but it's never spoken back.
That's right, Magnus says. Amari, meet Lucy. She's the only elevator for me.
I raise an eyebrow and add talking elevators to my fast-growing list of things that are actually things. Lucy, are you supernatural?
Not in the slightest, she replies. I'm what you'd call artificial intelligence. You'll find the Bureau operates on either advanced technology or magical objects, whichever works best for the job.
Cool, I say. Agent Magnus, asks Lucy, I presume you're taking trainee Peters to the youth dormitories?
That's right, he replies.
Then down we go. Lucy says. We drop into the floor, descending through the clear tube. The elevator goes dark. Now approaching, says Lucy, the Department of Supernatural Licenses and Records. A waiting room rises into view. Curious, I press my face into the glass to get a better look. Seated in the chair closest to the elevator is a cloud of smoke flipping through a newspaper. Next to it is a very bored-looking cyclops. It glances down at its ticket and rolls its large, bulging eye. An electronic sign at the center of the room flashes, now serving C26, and behind it is a long counter with people stationed at little windows. The elevator goes dark again. Now approaching, the Department of Creature Control. Flashing red lights fill the elevator as another room comes into view. Something large and scaly is coiled a few feet from the elevator. People in plastic suits sprint back and forth with fire extinguishers. A wide snake-like head emerges. The thing's cold yellow eyes find us in the elevator, and it spits a whirling ball of fire in our direction. With a shout, I jump to the back of the elevator just as flames reach it. No worries, says Lucy. I'm fireproof. That's not the first flame serpent to get loose, I'm afraid. Magnus laughs. Kid, if you could have seen your face. The elevator picks up speed. Now approaching, the Department of Magical Science. I only get a glimpse of the enormous room, but what I do see is amazing. Everyone floats, some upside down, like they're all in zero gravity or something.
Show-offs, Magnus grumbles. Tomorrow they'll all be invisible, just for the heck of it.
Now approaching, Lucy says quickly. The Department of Supernatural Investigations. It goes by in a blur. Lucy keeps calling out names, but we're dropping so fast now that it becomes a garbled mess. The elevator stops suddenly at a floor that looks like a hotel hallway. Crimson doors are spaced out every few steps, matching the rug that runs down the center of the hardwood floor. We've arrived at the youth dormitories, says Lucy. A tall, muscular woman in army fatigues steps into view. The doors open and she salutes Agent Magnus. Agent Magnus returns the salute.
Got a late arrival, Bertha. See to it she gets a room and a good night's rest. Big day tomorrow.
Bertha nods stiffly. I'll do my best to look after her while she's in my care.
Kid, he says to me, this is where you get off.
Quentin had a rule for whenever you find yourself in a new place. Fake it until you make it. That means doing your best to look confident, even if you don't feel confident. I step off the elevator and give the lady a smile, even as my insides are doing flips. The lady returns a smile so forced, it looks like she's in pain.
Good luck, says Agent Magnus as the elevator doors close.
Wait, I shout. With everything there is to see in this place, I almost forgot about the reason I'm here. Agent Magnus holds open the elevator doors. I want to ask you.
I know what you want to ask me about, he interrupts. Or rather, who? All information surrounding your brother's disappearance is classified. Nothing we're allowed to discuss with a trainee. It involves extremely dangerous matters you shouldn't concern yourself with.
What do you mean? I ask. He's my brother.
And he wouldn't want you in harm's way on his behalf. Focus on getting settled in.
His expression tells me he's not going to change his mind. So I set my face to show him I'm not budging either. If he won't tell me what I want to know, then I'll just have to find out on my own. Agent Magnus frowns as the elevator whisks him away.
Allow me to make one thing perfectly clear, says Bertha.
Her forced smile is now a sneer.
I don't care who your brother is. I am your dorm leader, and you will address me as ma'am, and you will like it. Understand?
I don't see that I have much of a choice. I nod. Bertha continues her speech as she leads me through a maze of hallways.
It's bad enough I have to rearrange things because you've upped and decided to exist. I'll not tolerate any nonsense, do you hear me? Put one foot out of line, and you'll find your stay here a short one.
The lady doesn't stop talking until we arrive at a door, and she gives it a knock. No answer. She gives it another try, harder this time. Still, no answer.
Bertha takes both hands and beats on the door so hard it rattles on its hinges. Finally, the door opens. A lanky girl with light tan skin, curly black hair, and thick glasses leans into the doorway, yawning.
Elsie Rodriguez, this is your new roommate, Bertha says.
The girl squints, her sleepy eyes going back and forth between me and Bertha. Then, like somebody flipped a switch, her eyes get big.
You! Come in! Tell me all about you!
An early start tomorrow means early bedtime tonight, Bertha cuts in. There will be plenty of time for bonding tomorrow. Lights out! The door slams shut behind me. It's pitch black in here.
What's her problem?
Shh, Elsie whispers. I take Elsie's advice and keep quiet. After a few seconds, I hear Bertha's loud shoes pound away. Once the footsteps fade completely, a small green flame pops to life, flooding the room with light. Elsie's face glows above a twisty little candle.
She'll see the light under the door, I say.
Elsie shakes her head.
It's a sneak candle. Anyone more than 3 feet away can't tell it's lit. Invented it myself.
That's pretty cool.
I glance around the shimmering green room and notice two more beds.
Do we have any other roommates?
Elsie's wide grin fades.
There were two other girls assigned to this room, but they both requested transfers.
You don't snore, do you?
She lowers her eyes.
It's worse than that, actually.
Okay, I say, a little off guard.
It can't be that bad.
She takes a slow, deep breath.
So, I'm kind of a dragon.
You're a dragon? I repeat. I almost want to laugh, but the look on Elsie's face tells me this is no joke.
You're serious?
Well, not a dragon, she answers. A were-dragon.
Like a werewolf? I ask. Like you can turn into a dragon? Elsie's shoulders slouch.
I was supposed to have my first shift years ago, but it just hasn't happened. And since I'm the last of my kind, there isn't anyone I can ask for help.
Oh, then your parents are both dead, Elsie finishes.
Were-dragons were considered extinct, like 500 years ago, at least until my egg was found in a deep-sea shipwreck off the coast of Mexico. We can't hatch without sunlight. A dragon expert from the Department of Creature Control became my legal guardian and took me in, she sighs. But once my 12th birthday passed, without a single shift, the Bureau declared me essentially human. And now, I'm here.
What's it like, being the last of your kind?
Lonelier than you can imagine.
She gestures to the two empty beds. They told Bertha that they didn't want to wake up one night to find a dragon snacking on their legs. She sighs. Not an unreasonable request, all things considered.
Well, I'm not afraid. I'm surprised by how much I mean those words.
Maybe it's because I know how it feels to have people judge me before they even get to know me.
Really?
She asks, beaming. Nervously, I extend a hand. Friends? She grabs hold and shakes it fiercely.
Absolutely!
Friends don't eat friends, dragon or not. Elsie gets a good laugh out of that.
Words to live by.
It's then that I notice the wall above Elsie's bed. It's covered in pictures. Elsie follows my eyes.
Oh my gosh, I'm the biggest Vanquish fan on the planet. I've got all six of their action figures, even the super rare Junior Agent editions. A whole drawer full of t-shirts, a blanket, three coffee mugs, and like 20 posters.
Vanquish? Oh, that's right. Elsie's eyes go wide. You wouldn't have known anything about the supernatural world until your nomination.
Vanquish is the nickname for the two most famous agents of the last 50 years, Maria Van Helsing and your brother, Quentin Peters. The Van is from Maria's last name, and the Qui is from Quentin's first name, with a sh on the end. Get it? They vanquish the bad guys. How cool is that?
I double over laughing. There's just no way my dorky big brother is some celebrity.
Seriously?
Elsie nods enthusiastically.
Vanquish single-handedly defeated the last surviving Night Brother. It was the biggest arrest in centuries.
Before I can ask what a Night Brother is, Elsie holds up the sneak candle to show me her collection of magazine covers, centered around a small Mexican flag, stretching up to the ceiling. The magazines have names like Elf Magazine and Harper's Bazaar and Dead Book, a ghoulish fashion guide. There's even a very sticky-looking slime magazine beside a Supernatural Geographic. Whatever the title, each cover shows a picture of the same pretty blonde girl next to my grinning big brother.
Wow.
There's a whole side to my brother that he kept hidden from me. I mean, while I was spending my summers doing cannonballs at the community rec center pool, Quentin was out saving the world.
Can I ask you something?
I say.
Sure,
says Elsie. This might sound weird, but do you have any idea what happened to my brother? It's been 6 months since we've heard from him.
Elsie frowns.
No one knows. They vanished without a trace.
Nobody went looking for them?
Sure, says Elsie. Plenty of people did, from all over the supernatural world. The Bureau even set up a special hotline for tips. You wouldn't believe the kinds of rewards that were offered for information leading to their whereabouts.
Did the Bureau find out anything?
I ask. If so, they didn't make it public. The last press report only said that Vanquish is considered missing in action and that all details surrounding the investigation are confidential.
My shoulders droop. I thought for sure that coming here would finally give me some real answers about Quentin, but it's just as big a mystery in the supernatural world as it is back home. But I can't give up just yet. Not until I talk to everyone who knew him here. Somebody has to know something.
Maybe some music will cheer you up.
Elsie sets the sneak candle on the floor beside her bed and crawls underneath. She returns with a small black box covered in dials and buttons. Two long antennae rise out of the top.
A radio?
I ask.
Yep.
Built it using spare parts. I shake my head.
You're brilliant, you know.
My roommate grins.
Want to test it out?
Definitely. Elsie sets it down on the floor and presses a few buttons. Suddenly, a man's voice blares from the speakers.
Hot 159.7 FM. The station that's always keeping you informed on the latest news from all corners of the supernatural world. Elsie slams down on the large red button at the center of the radio, killing the sound. She blows out the sneak candle, and we both crawl into bed as fast as possible. If Bertha is anywhere nearby, we're in trouble. I cringe at the idea of having to explain to Mama that I got kicked out an hour into being here. Please don't let this cost me the chance to find Quentin. A few minutes pass, but no one comes. That was close, says Elsie in the dark. Too close, I say. Want to try again? Now that my heart has stopped pounding, I have to admit, I am still curious. There's so much about this world that I don't know. Only if you're sure you can get the volume right this time. The sneak candle pops on again, and Elsie fidgets with the dials. The voice returns, quieter. Bureau has yet to release a statement regarding the string of incidents believed to involve monstrous human-animal hybrids occurring in both the United States and Europe over the past few months. These creatures, known for their extraordinary size, speed, and strength, as well as their disturbing ferocity, are perhaps the most devious product of magician craft, a forced, unnatural fusion of man and beast. But with Raoul Moreau locked away in Blackstone Prison and his brother in arms, Count Vladimir, long deceased, the Supernatural World Congress has begun to express concerns that a new magician has surfaced. A new magician? Says Elsie with a shiver. That's a scary thought.
Really? What's so scary about a magician?
I ask. Magicians? In the supernatural world, aren't like stage magicians in the known world, says Elsie. They have real magic, lots of it too, much more than the Supernatural World Congress allows humans to have. Remember what I said earlier about Vanquish being famous for capturing the last surviving Night Brother? Well, that's the same Moreau. The Night Brothers were two of the most powerful magicians there's ever been. They waged war on the entire supernatural world ages ago and almost won.
Lights out means get to sleep!
Bertha's voice is like a crack of thunder outside our door, and we scramble to put everything away and climb into bed. But as soon as our dorm leader leaves again, Elsie says, I can't wait to get my badge tomorrow. My overall potential rose really high on the badge tester, so I feel pretty good. I think back on my own badge test and swallow. What's it mean if the badge tester decided to self-destruct? In the dark, I hear Elsie gasp. It means you've got so much potential, the badge tester couldn't contain it all. Amari, I bet you're getting a Moonstone badge tomorrow.
Moonstone? I didn't see that on the chart.
They're extremely rare. She replies, it means something about you is special, legendary. Quentin got one too.
Me? Legendary? No way. What happens when they discover I'm not like Quentin at all?
Hey, it's nothing to worry over, says Elsie. You could be a hero, just like your brother. I try to play cool. Who says I'm worried? I probably should have mentioned that I can see people's emotions, even in the dark. If you were a dragon, we could communicate telepathically, but with humans it's like an aura of different colors, and your yellow haze tells me you're plenty worried.
Yeah, well, you should have been upfront about that too, I say angrily.
You're right. I'm sorry. A moment passes, and she adds, I really do think you could be a hero. I didn't come here to be a hero, I say, still annoyed. I'm here to find out what happened to my brother. My roommate doesn't say anything to that. I know immediately I should apologize, that I'm too quick to get upset sometimes. Truth is, I am worried. Nobody would want me for a hero.
but she's already snoring. Me? I don't sleep much at all.
9.
An ear-shattering knock jolts my eyes open. Not that I'm fully asleep. Elsie is still snoring, so I roll out of bed and drag myself to the door. As I turn the knob, another loud knock comes. It's Bertha.
"You're late,"
she barks, pushing her way into the room. "Didn't you hear my knock an hour ago?"
"You didn't knock,"
I say, annoyed and still sleepy. "I would have heard it." Bertha whirls around to face me.
"You calling me a liar?"
I'm about to tell her just how much of a liar I think she is when Elsie grabs my shoulder.
"Must have overslept,"
Elsie says with a nervous laugh.
"You do well to follow your roommate's example and own up to your mistakes," says Bertha. "You two should have been in the underground auditorium 5 minutes ago. I suggest you change into your uniforms, make those beds, and hightail it down there."
She turns and stomps out of the room.
"No way she knocked,"
I tell Elsie. "I know she didn't, but we're just trainees. She's picking on us because she knows there's no one we can complain to yet.
Just wait until we've been accepted into a department. Things will be different. Promise."
Inside the small closet behind the two empty beds hangs two pairs of black pants, two neatly pressed white blouses, and polished black shoes. Elsie and I get dressed, brush our teeth, and make our beds in 2 minutes flat. We race up the hall to find the elevator. While we wait for one, I decide now is a good time to make things right. She's the first friend I've made in forever. I can't mess this up.
"Hey, no worries,"
she interrupts.
"You're forgiven."
"But how did you know what I was going to say?"
"Your aura is white," Elsie explains.
"Apologetic." I can't help but smile.
"That's pretty useful,"
Elsie grins.
"Has its moments."
Finally, an elevator slides into view, and we take it all the way down to what looks like a well-lit cave. Various tunnels with neon signs at their entrances veer off in different directions. One sign says, "International Railway Station, Bureau of Supernatural Affairs this way." Another says, "Department of Hidden Places this way." Or is it? A lady comes running out of the largest tunnel. Her name tag says Secretary to the Chief.
"Where on earth have you two been? The ceremony's about to begin."
She throws an arm around each of us and runs us back the way she came. We follow the winding passage until we walk through a golden door set into the tunnel wall. A long, narrow hallway ends in another set of gold doors. As we approach, the hum of a crowd begins to echo off the walls, raising hairs on the back of my neck. How many people are here? We pass through this set of doors onto the floor level of an enormous auditorium. I was expecting something close to the fancy Jefferson Academy auditorium, but this place is more suited for a professional basketball team. Above us, on the ceiling of this great big cavern, are thousands and thousands of blue-green shimmers that I recognize instantly from my fifth grade world geography class. They're the same glowworms found in the Waitomo glowworm caves in New Zealand.
Wow,
I never thought I'd see them in person. It's way cooler than Mrs. Varner's dusty film projector. I don't realize I'm standing in a total daze until the secretary gives me a tug to keep moving. The auditorium is dimly lit, with most of the lighting focused on the stage, where a stout white lady stands behind a wide glass podium. At the back of the stage, a massive screen displays her round face and neatly trimmed brown hair. My eyes pop at the sight of the fish gills on her neck. Seated in the rows and rows of seats below her are kids of all colors, all around my age, and all wearing the same uniform. A camera flash blinds me. A swarm of faces,
some encased in glass tanks, some covered in fur, some with way too many fangs, quickly surround the three of us, hurling questions at me from every direction.
Amari, rumor has it someone's getting a Moonstone badge today. Is it you?
Miss Peters, will you follow in your brother's footsteps and become an agent? If you join the Department of Supernatural Investigations, will you take up the search for Vanquish? I freeze up, stuck between wanting everyone to know I'm here to find my brother and hating being the center of attention. I just stand there, my eyes darting between them, until thankfully, the secretary shoos them away as she rushes me and Elsie down the aisle toward the stage. A full commotion breaks out in the seats. Kids stand to get a better look at us, face burning. I pretend not to notice. The secretary seats us in empty chairs at the very end of the first row, next to a tall blonde-haired boy whose posture is so perfect he might as well be a statue. The creases in his uniform look sharp enough to injure somebody. He cuts a glance at me and then whispers something to the girl beside him. She snickers. I sink in my seat a little. What is it about me that turns people off so much? The secretary lady gives a thumbs up to the stage. The woman with the gills nods and steps to the podium. Let's get started. My name is Elizabeth Crow, and I'm chief director here at the Bureau of Supernatural Affairs. I'd like to personally welcome you all. There's not a cooler summer camp in the whole world. The auditorium applauds, and Chief Crow continues. The ceremony these young cadets are about to undertake is of the utmost importance. Each will be assigned a badge based on what we believe to be their current overall potential, but that's only half the reason for this occasion. The first law established by the very first Supernatural World Congress states that in order for one to be allowed entry into the supernatural world, one must be supernatural. For this reason, we will make each of you so. I sit up in my chair. They're going to make us supernatural? How? I glance down the row at the other kids, but no one else seems surprised by this. All of you possess a unique talent that we will enhance into a supernatural ability through an ancient gem gifted to us by the famed elf Merlin. For instance, if you are someone who is constantly being told how good a listener you are, once you've touched the crystal ball, you might find yourself capable of hearing through walls. Some of you will have a pretty good idea which of your talents will be enhanced. A great many more of you are in for a surprise. However, no matter the nature of your supernatural ability, rest assured there is a place for you somewhere within the Bureau. So we get a supernatural ability based on our talents. But I don't have any special talents I can think of. At least nothing that could be turned into something cool like listening through walls. Allow me to say just one more thing to those of you receiving lesser badges today, Chief Crow continues. While it's true that badges are important in identifying those children we feel will be extraordinary additions to our ranks, don't allow your initial badge to define your career with the Bureau. Hard work can improve your badge over time. My position as Chief Director is a testament to that. I was only awarded a wooden badge when I first arrived at the Bureau. She taps on the shiny gold badge pinned to her jacket. But now, you can all see it's quite golden. So strive for excellence. Now, without further ado, let us proceed to the badge presentations and talent enhancements.
Please let Elsie be wrong about me getting that Moonstone badge.
The idea of having a badge higher than the chief director's makes me queasy. While we all clap, me a lot less enthusiastically than the other kids in my row, Chief Crow pushes her podium to the edge of the stage. From the other side, three men in dark suits push a hulking metal contraption front and center.
Attached to the front is a crystal ball that stands around 5 feet tall. The ceremony begins with the notebook paper badges. A short brunette girl named Aspen Matthews is the first to be called on stage to shake hands with the chief director, who hands her a smooth wooden box containing her badge. Then it's over to the machine to place her hand on the crystal ball, which glows faintly white at her touch. The giant screen blinks and then shows talent enhanced to supernatural ability, orderliness to freakish organization skills. I turn to Elsie. Freakish organization skills? I know someone with that ability. If she was carrying a huge stack of papers and tripped, they'd all land exactly like she had them before. Elsie grimaces. She'll probably end up in the Department of Supernatural Licenses and Records, filing papers. The crowd claps, and Aspen is led off stage. Why would anyone want to be in a boring department like that? I ask. Well, some people do prefer easier, less dangerous departments, says Elsie. But usually it's one of two reasons. Either it's all you qualify for, or you make it to age 18 without passing any tryouts, and the Bureau just sends you wherever they need people. Non-competitive departments like supernatural licenses and records don't even have a tryout. My name still hasn't been called by the time all of the plastic badges have been handed out. Uneasy, I glance over and catch Statue Boy watching me from the corner of his eye. He quickly looks away and then back to me. He says, I wasn't staring. Didn't say you were. Oh, well, good then. He turns his attention back to the stage. What's his problem? Even with my growing knot of dread, things start to get more exciting by the time the bronze badges finally roll around. Not only does the crystal ball glow brighter when touched, but rarer abilities start popping up. A grinning kid named Billy Pogo's knack for being in the right place at the right time becomes unnatural luck. While he's on stage, he gets a phone call stating he'll be inheriting his great aunt's golden fleece collection. Jonathan John's talent is hiding, and once it's enhanced, he happily demonstrates by turning his body into clear glass. He announces to everyone he's aiming for the Department of Spies and Secrets. Elsie elbows me and says, Betcha he doesn't know that he'll have to get his memory erased every time he leaves the department. A dreamy-eyed girl named Julia Farsight's supernatural ability makes her a medium, a result she seems more than surprised to receive. Elsie bursts out laughing when I ask if it's better than being a small. I don't realize my mistake until Elsie says that she'll probably choose the Department of the Dead. Elsie is one of the only 13 kids to receive a silver badge, meaning I've either got a gold badge or the scary moonstone badge. Chief Crow puts her arm around Elsie on stage and speaks briefly about the diversity benefits of having members who aren't fully human. She herself is half Atlantean. Elsie doesn't get a huge reaction from the crowd, so I make sure to stand up and holler, Go, Elsie! Statue Boy frowns as I sit back down. Not that I care. Badge in hand, Elsie moves nervously toward the crystal ball. She places her free hand against the crystal. It glows bright white, shimmering like a giant 100-watt bulb. Talent enhanced to supernatural ability, inventiveness to mastermind inventor. Elsie beams. Her talent doesn't surprise me one bit. But then, having created that sneak candle and her own radio from spare parts, I'd have thought she was a mastermind inventor already. It's no wonder the Bureau has such amazing technology. They turn smart people into geniuses. I try again to think of something I'm really good at. Falling asleep on the sofa after school? I doubt the Bureau would have much use for that. As Elsie returns to her seat, Chief Crow steps back to her podium. Only once every few years do we get the honor of presenting an elite badge. And yet this year, we shall present three. Dylan and Laura Van Helsing, please come up and accept your gold badges.
Van Helsing? Why does that name sound so familiar?
Then it hits me. My brother's partner. I nudge Elsie.
Are those two related to Maria Van Helsing?
She nods.
Maria is the Van Helsing twins' older sister. Their mom and dad are here too. The Van Helsings are one of the most important families in the supernatural world.
Is that why Statue Boy was staring?
My whole body goes stiff as another realization comes. If they've got gold badges, that Moonstone badge really does belong to me. So much for blending in.
Laura and Dylan both smile and wave toward the flashing cameras as they make their way to the stage. It's easy to see they're used to this kind of attention. Loud applause and cheers ring out in the auditorium. Laura's polite grin bursts into a big, toothy smile as she jogs up the few steps to the stage where Chief Crow swallows her in a big hug. Dylan does a better job controlling his emotions and gives the chief a firm handshake. The whole auditorium hears the chief tell them how proud she is. All three pose for a few more pictures, and then both Van Helsings are handed their badges. Dylan moves to the crystal ball first. His cool smile is gone. In fact, he looks scared to death. Guess I'm not the only one questioning what kind of supernatural ability they'll have. I lean forward in my chair, curious. Dylan shakes out his hands and touches the crystal ball with just the tips of his fingers. The instant he does, blinding light pours out of the crystal ball, so bright I have to cover my eyes. Finally, his results show on screen. Talent enhanced to supernatural ability. Marksmanship to physics-defying aim. Dylan looks as happy as I've ever seen anyone in my entire life. When his sister steps to the crystal ball, her talent starts off as fitness and becomes superhuman athleticism. Laura decides to test out her supernatural ability, doing a long run of impossible jumps and flips across the stage. It looks like the special effects from a superhero movie. The crowd goes nuts. After a few bows, Laura practically skips off the stage, her smirking brother right behind her. The lights dim further as Chief Crow returns to the podium. And now, for a very special presentation, the reason, I expect, that we have so many additional spectators this year. Amari Peters, please accompany me on stage. Every eye in the auditorium watches me. Cameras flash like crazy. I'm not used to being the center of attention. Not for something good anyway. The walk to the stage seems endless. My hands shake as I climb the stairs. My flushed face takes up the giant screen once I step on stage. Chief Crow smiles warmly and puts her arm around my shoulder. It's very rare indeed that a Moonstone badge is awarded. Rarer still to have two in the same family. There have only been 13 in the whole history of the Bureau, and Amari here makes the second Peters to receive the honor. The chief reaches into her suit jacket and pulls out a tiny wooden case. I present to you the 14th Moonstone ever awarded. She tilts it open, and I peek inside. The round badge looks a lot like a medal without the ribbon. It's the size of my palm and twinkles in its case like a tiny star. It's the most beautiful, most wonderful thing I've ever owned. It's also the badge my perfect brother received and all those accomplished Bureau members before him. I don't deserve it. Still, I take the case and everyone claps. Even with my doubts, I smile at the attention. It doesn't feel real, like it's happening to someone else.
I spot Elsie bouncing in her seat in the front row. Then I spot the twins, both sitting stiffly, arms crossed.
Jealous much?
Now it's my turn to touch the crystal ball. I step past Chief Crow and frown. I'm suddenly nervous at the prospect of revealing something about myself in front of all these people. What if my supernatural ability turns out to be something disappointing, like superhuman knitting? I was really good at it when I was little. The truth is, I don't even know myself well enough to guess what it might choose. But everyone's waiting. Reluctantly, I place my hand on the crystal ball. And nothing happens. Not even the faintest glimmer of light. There's a collective gasp from the crowd. Cameras begin to flash again. I look to Chief Crow, but she seems as confused as I am. And then something does happen. A plume of black smoke appears, swirling and filling the ball completely. A crack reaches across the surface. I yank my hand away, take a few steps backward. So does Chief Crow. The screen flickers behind us. Talent enhanced to supernatural ability. Dormant magic to active magician. Illegal. The auditorium erupts. 10. I sit in a cold room at the end of a long wooden table. After I was rushed off stage by Chief Crow, she instructed two ladies in gray suits to bring me to a door marked conference room. What happened back there? How could my talent be magic? I couldn't even pull off the simplest stuff in the magic tricks for beginners playset I got for Christmas that one time. I didn't even know that real magic existed until just recently. I cover my face with my hands. If having magic makes me a magician, and magicians are the enemies of the supernatural world like Elsie suggested, then what's going to happen to me now? Raised voices and hurried steps echo in the hallway. Heart pounding, I sit up straighter in my chair. The door to the conference room swings open, and half a dozen adults rush in. I only recognize Chief Crow, who dashes over and grabs me by both shoulders. Are you all right, sweetheart? I nod. What happened back there? That's what we're trying to determine, says Chief Crow. But to do so, we'll need to conduct a very important test. Do we have your permission? I swallow and nod again. From the worried looks on everyone's faces, it's probably the only answer they'd accept. Chief Crow backs away. Dr. Khan, if you wouldn't mind. Certainly, replies a jittery South Asian man in a long white lab coat. He steps forward to place a square piece of metal on the floor in front of my chair. The little screen near the top makes it look like a scale. Why would they need to check my weight? Remove your shoes and socks, please. You'll need to stand on it with your bare feet for the magic meter to work properly. Magic meter? Maybe there really was a glitch with the crystal ball, and this will prove that whatever happened back there was a mistake. It had to be. The grown-ups all stare expectantly, especially a tall, stern-faced white guy who keeps pacing back and forth near the door. I pull off my shoes and socks and get to my feet. Then I take a slow, deep breath and step onto the magic meter. Numbers rise and fall on the little screen until finally it settles on 97%. A second later, it creeps up to 98%, then 99%, and finally 100%. Dr. Khan gasps. Every drop of this girl's blood is magical. The adults rush to huddle near the door. Dr. Khan just stares at me, eyes wide, so I ask, what does that mean? It means you're perhaps the most magical being that's ever existed. Dr. Khan lowers his eyes and frowns. It also means your very existence is a crime.
A crime? But I haven't done anything. The Bureau uses magical objects, don't they? So magic can't be all that bad.
The Bureau isn't against objects being too magical, Dr. Khan replies. It's against people being too magical. There's a big difference, I'm afraid.
Chief Crow is back in front of me.
Amari, we're going to ask you some questions. It's important that you be completely honest with us. Understand? But I've got my own questions.
How did I get magic?
It was my hope that you might tell us, says the stern-faced man.
He crosses his arms, turning up his nose like he can't stand the sight of me. His golden name tag reads, Director Van Helsing, Department of Supernatural Investigations. He must be Maria's and the Van Helsing twins' dad. My heart thumps faster.
I don't know, I say. I touched the crystal ball like everyone else.
Director Van Helsing bangs his fist on the table so hard it makes everyone in the room jump.
The fourth law created by the first Supernatural World Congress states quite clearly that humans may receive magic from only one source, the crystal ball. A single 10% dose that gives us our supernatural abilities. Yet you have come to the Bureau with an overabundance of magic from an unknown source. Where did you get it?
I don't know, I say. It's got to be a mistake.
Tell the truth, he says.
I am, I shout back, trembling. Director Van Helsing won't let up.
You expect us to believe that you possess the highest magicality we've ever tested by mere chance?
No. I mean, yes. I mean,
I'm shaking so much I don't even know what I'm saying.
And I suppose we're also to believe it's a coincidence.
Director Van Helsing continues that you showed up here at the same time hybrids are terrorizing our outposts around the country. It is common knowledge that only magicians can create hybrids. Tell me, girl, are these attacks you're doing?
I don't know anything about that.
I shrink back in my chair.
I swear.
Then perhaps, Director Van Helsing interrupts, you could simply tell us which other magician is responsible.
The door swings open again, and Agent Magnus steps through.
I'm here to speak on the kid's behalf. A tall lady with fiery red hair and a long ponytail hovers in the doorway behind him.
Director Van Helsing frowns.
This is a director-level meeting.
Magnus rolls his eyes.
Like I care a lick about that.
For the last time, you are not above the rules, Agent Magnus.
He looks to the chief, but she just waves him off.
This is no time for you to quarrel, snaps Chief Crow. Let Magnus in. He was close to the girl's brother and might know something that could shed some light on how on Earth Quentin's little sister is, of all the things in the world, a magician.
She nods to the lady in the doorway.
Agent Fiona, I think we'd all feel a lot better if you could put that ability of yours to use and reveal the girl's intentions.
The red-haired lady nods and steps forward. She may not be a director like the other adults, but they all move aside for her.
No need to be frightened, lass, she says softly. If you'll allow it, I'm going to check out your intentions for being here. You'll feel yourself go still for a bit, but that's the worst of it.
If you've truly got nothing to hide, says Director Van Helsing, crossing his arms, then you'll have no objections to our proving it.
Again, I don't have much of a choice. If I refuse, then they'll just assume the worst. I meet Agent Fiona's eyes.
Okay.
The room goes quiet as Agent Fiona puts herself right in front of me. Her fierce blue eyes widen, and my whole body goes stiff. I try to look away, but my neck refuses to turn. My eyes are stuck on hers. I can't even close them. I'm totally helpless. I fight down my fear as best I can. It's not until she finally blinks that I can move again. She cracks a smile. Her intentions might as well be in big neon letters across her forehead. They're so easy to read. She's an honest little thing. On the surface, the last means to bolt for the door if she's not treated fairly in this meeting. Second, and most importantly, she's come to the Bureau to discover what happened to her brother and bring him home if she can. There's nothing dangerous in her intentions as far as I can tell. I blink in surprise as the adults in the room exchange glances. Did that lady just read my mind? Normally I'd put complete faith in your ability, Fiona, says Director Van Helsing, but magicians are known for their deception. It's true, I say. I just want to find Quentin. Do you imagine there's something you could be doing better? Director Van Helsing scoffs. My best agents were on that search. Magnus led the investigation himself. Agent Magnus looks at me with sad eyes. With the investigation being classified, the most I can say is, we're currently out of leads. Chief Crow's tense expression relaxes a little. We're all sorry about Quentin, and I'm quite relieved to hear that Amari means us no harm. I've got the utmost faith in Agent Fiona's ability, but there's still the troubling matter of how the girl became a magician. It's been more than 2 centuries since the last rogue magician emerged, and he quite famously blew himself up. Does the how even matter? Drones a pale, thin man. His name tag reads, Director Crypt, Department of the Dead. The Bureau has had one policy for dealing with magicians for over 7 centuries. Lock them up and throw away the key. A few of the other directors nod in agreement. A serious lady in thick black glasses even suggests I be taken to her lab and studied. Director Focus, Department of Magical Science, is sewn onto her lab coat. Over my dead body, Magnus replies. And mine too, I think. The red-haired lady moves to Magnus's side, leveling a withering stare at the directors who want me locked up. She and Magnus must be partners. Please, everyone just calm down, says Chief Crow. What we need right now is a thoughtful discussion about how best to proceed. Can I start by acknowledging that the kid's supernatural ability didn't pop up as evilness or spite, says Magnus. So let's stop treating her like she did something wrong. And yet we've all heard the terrible stories, haven't we? Says Director Cobblepot of the Department of Supernatural Licenses and Records. There's no such thing as a good magician. Let's not forget how close we came to canceling the training sessions this summer on account of those hybrid attacks. More shouting follows. Chief Crow closes her eyes and shakes her head. Someone clears their throat loudly, quieting the room. If I might have a word on the matter, says a gentlemanly voice. I look around to see who's talking, but no one's lips are moving. That's when Director Crypt opens his suit jacket and places the head of an elderly brown man with a gray handlebar mustache gently onto the table. It takes my brain a few seconds to catch up to what my eyes are seeing, and when it does, I jump in my seat. Where's the rest of you? The words come out before I can stop myself, but the man isn't offended. Back in my office, taking a most restful nap. What began as flexibility became detachability once I touched the crystal ball, those many years ago. He winks at me. Now then, as director of the unexplained, I believe the great many unanswerable questions surrounding young Amari here means that she falls squarely under my jurisdiction. I glance over at Magnus. He doesn't seem to like my being considered unexplained any more than I do.
And what would you have us do? Asks Chief Crow.
When faced with a mystery, one must first determine if said mystery presents a danger. We've established that the girl means us no immediate harm. The next step, then, is not to project our own prejudices onto the mystery, but rather to allow the mystery to reveal itself to us in its own time, which is to say that I believe we should allow the girl to stay, if she wants to. She'd be monitored, of course, but discreetly. Also, it may be prudent to explain to her exactly why being a magician has caused such a commotion. All eyes turn to me.
That really would be helpful, I say.
Allow me, says Chief Crow. In ancient times, long before the Bureau existed, there wasn't the separation between the known world and the supernatural world that exists now. Humans lived right alongside supernaturals, and those supernaturals performed magic right out in the open. The thing was, with all the free-flowing magic that existed in the world, humanity had none of it, not a single drop, until the Knight Brothers, Sergei Vladimir and Raoul Moreau. No one knows how the two of them obtained magic, just that they weren't satisfied with the 35% magicality of a common elf, or even the 50% magicality of a woodland hag. They gave themselves more power than any single being has a right to possess. It's said that they could perform seemingly impossible feats. We know for a fact that they conquered old age and death with a spell called Vampyr, which requires consuming the blood of innocents. I shudder.
Vampires?
Chief Crow pauses, visibly upset, so Agent Fiona picks up where she left off.
Ye can imagine that supernatural folk didn't take too kindly to humans terrorizing the land and upsetting the peace. And humans and supernaturals banded together to bring down the Knight Brothers. But they were no match for the magicians. It seemed hopeless that the Knight Brothers would take control of the whole bloody world.
Until my ancestor, Director Van Helsing cuts in, Abraham Van Helsing, drove a stake through Vladimir's heart, a blow that sent Moreau into hiding and scattered their forces. On the strength of my ancestor's courage, certain humans were privileged to remain in contact with the supernatural world and enforce laws meant to keep its existence secret. These trusted men and women became the Bureau of Supernatural Affairs. For the nearly 700 years that the Bureau has existed, Moreau has continued to create new magician apprentices until he was finally captured by my daughter and your brother. These newer magicians have been the cause of great tragedies and terrible disasters these many years. Humanity was never meant for such power. It corrupts the soul. That's quite enough, grumbles Magnus. Leave your beliefs out of it.
I sit very still, trying to wrap my head around everything they've said.
You're saying the magic I have is bad?
At best, we're saying we don't know, says the talking head. The amount of magic we receive from the crystal ball is but a fraction of what even the weakest magician possesses. At such high concentrations, we simply don't know what effects the magic, now that it's active, may have on you.
I don't feel any different, I say.
It does raise an interesting question. How can we be sure her talent was even enhanced? Asks Agent Fiona. The ball didn't glow. In fact, it very nearly shattered, says Director Crypt.
Let's not pretend that means nothing. Can you imagine how difficult it's going to be to explain to Merlin how we let a trainee destroy a priceless artifact of unending power?
No explanation will be necessary, says Director Focus. I rushed over right after with a couple of my best researchers to have a look at the damage. And there just wasn't any. The ball was in pristine condition, its magic functioning normally.
What happened then? Asks Chief Crow. In my professional opinion, the incident with the crystal ball revealed just what kind of magician Amari is.
Director Focus swallows. She's an illusionist. If she possesses any other kind of magic in addition to this, such as what's necessary to create hybrids, it remains to be seen.
The directors look at one another with nervous glances. Even Magnus looks concerned.
So what happened on stage with the crystal ball was just an illusion. I'm not sure what to think about that.
I just wish we had more information. Chief Crow frowns. If Horus were here, he could peek into the girl's history. Maybe discover how the magic was passed to her.
She turns to Director Van Helsing. I trust he's still away on sabbatical, in the Wandering Isles?
Afraid so, says Director Van Helsing. The Isles were last seen just off the coast of Africa, but that was days ago. They could be anywhere in the world by now.
Can we summon one of his underlings from the Department of Good Fortunes and Bad Omens to give us some advice on the matter? Asks Director Focus.
The chief shakes her head. I'd rather have Horus himself on something this important.
Is this really a risk we're willing to take? Asks Director Van Helsing, throwing up his arms. That she might not be so bad because her brother is a hero? Is it not the height of recklessness to allow a magician to roam freely inside the bureau while there are still so many unanswered questions?
And just what do you suggest? Growls Magnus. Lock her up for something she can't help?
Fiona's already proven the girl isn't up to anything nefarious.
Or perhaps she's been prepped to fool Fiona's supernatural ability, answers Director Van Helsing.
At the very least, we ought to erase the girl's memories of the supernatural world, erase her memories of being a magician, and then send her home to be carefully watched. She'd go back to being just an ordinary girl, and no danger to the Bureau or the supernatural world.
No, I say, jumping to my feet. You can't erase my memories. If you do, I'll never be able to find my brother. Let me stay. I'll prove that I'm just like any other trainee. Please.
Director Van Helsing starts to say something more, but Chief Crow asks for quiet.
We all watch her pace back and forth a few times. Finally, she comes to a stop right next to me. I can see benefits to both requests. But let's not forget, it was Quentin himself who nominated her.
There is not a person in this room who would question his judgment were he standing here.
And so we shall give you the benefit of the doubt, Miss Peters. But understand that you'll be on the shortest possible leash. I won't compromise the safety of the Bureau. Understand?
A wave of relief and then nervousness rushes through me.
I understand.
Good, she replies. Prove that we're right to trust you. Prove you belong here.
11. After the meeting, Agent Magnus escorts me to an elevator named Whispers, which surprisingly shouts out the name of every floor we pass. It's lucky for my ears that the special events floor is only a few stops up. As I follow Agent Magnus off the elevator, a voice comes over the intercom.
This is your chief director speaking. With regard to this morning's unfortunate event, we are still working out the particulars of what exactly occurred and why. Rest assured that once we have this information, we will be forthcoming with an explanation. In the meantime, trainee Amari Peters is to be treated no differently from any other trainee. That is all.
They were the ones who wanted to treat you differently in the first place.